This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air's critics help you keep up with the latest books, records, TV shows, and films. Today, instead of reviewing other people's work, they're going to talk about their own and share some of their adventures in the fascinating but sometimes risky world of pop culture criticism. Our discussion was recorded a couple of weeks ago at the annual Public Radio Conference in San Antonio, Texas. The audience was made up of program directors, station managers, and producers from public radio stations around the country. Let me tell you about our panelists. David Bianculli is Fresh Air's TV critic. He's written about TV for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the New York Post, and now the New York Daily News. He's also the author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic. He's the former rock critic for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner and the Philadelphia Inquirer. He now writes about pop culture for Entertainment Weekly. Maureen Corrigan is Fresh Air's book critic. She writes a mystery page for the Washington Post Book Review. Her reviews have also been published in the Village Voice and the New York Observer. She teaches at Georgetown University. I asked them first if they're ever punished for bad reviews, if publicists, advertisers, or the artists themselves ever try to get back at critics. Ken Tucker had this story.
When I was working for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, I wrote Billy Joel was in town for like a week, and this was my crowning moment in media publicity. I wrote a fair, reasonably scathing review of Billy Joel. And the next night, I'm told he brought it out onto the stage, brought the review out on the stage, put it on the piano, and before each song, he read what I had written about each particular song. And then at the end of the concert, he took the review, tore it up in little pieces, and said, "F*** you, Ken Tucker!" So I was living in Los Angeles, and then like that night I'm getting calls from the New York Post saying, "Well, we understand Billy Joel just said you." It's like, "Do you have a comment?" You know, it was like sort of nationwide news, coast to coast. Billy Joel abuses poor defenseless critic.
Well, did you have a comment to the press? Did you want to keep the feud going, or did you want to just cut it?
Yeah, I sort of wanted to keep it going for a little while, just to see how far it would go, but it didn't last very long.
Might I point out, although this is not a direct answer to your question, that our esteemed rock critic has just used the F word only 12 fewer times than Madonna.
Let me ask you this.
Being recorded for broadcast.
Ken, what you just said, you could have not told this anecdote in exactly those words on Fresh Air. And in fact, when we broadcast this on Fresh Air, we will bleep out those words, as our radio listeners who have heard this tape already have heard. Could you have used those words in Entertainment Weekly or in any of the newspapers that you've written?
No.
How do you
no.
feel about that? Do you think that you should be able to?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I really think that the people reading reviews, I don't worry. I mean, I have three kids, and I'm not worried about kids coming upon these words in newspapers and having their lives destroyed, you know? I think on some level it's just sort of one more tool that you can't use in terms of being precise and vivid and humorous about what you're doing, both on my end of it and on the artist's end of it.
Let's get back to punishment. David, have you ever been punished for
only socially? No, I mean that seriously. I mean, like, I'm like this Bartleby the Scrivener guy, you know, who never leaves his basement except to record Fresh Air. I just write everything and send it out by computer. And it's like, "Would you like to come to this party?" "No, thank you. I would prefer not to." And I just stay there and write. But whenever I do show up in social situations, the immediate thing I have to, when I see somebody coming, like, you know, the last party that I was at, and I'd never met her before, Katie Couric, sort of, in a nice way, attacked me for when she interviewed Bette Midler and asked Bette Midler to teach her this particular mincing walk that she did. I wrote in the Daily News that it was closer to T&A than Q&A. And it was just a joke. But Katie wasn't particularly sold on the idea, or at least the execution of the humor. And so, I mean, so that sort of thing, I get phone calls a lot from people that I dump on, and I, you made too. But that's part of the deal of doing business. So I don't mind that. But I've never had, I mean, nobody, I wish I could do something that would make people quit sending me TV shows, you know, but I haven't stumbled on that formula yet.
Maureen, ever punished?
Well, the same thing. I have people who track me down to my office and tell me that
quote unquote, I've ruined their life because I've given them a bad review. And it's never pleasant. I mean, it's not a fun encounter to have an author on the phone who's heartbroken over a review.
Now, do you feel like, well, I've really ruined this person's life, I've ruined their career, how can I ever give a bad review again? I'd better get out of this business. Who can stand hurting somebody's feelings like that?
I don't enjoy it. But I'm dealing with the work. I'm not dealing with the person.
You feel like you're trying to get at some kind of larger truth about how you respond to the book. And if a life is ruined, no.
If a life is, it's in the service of art, so who cares, right? Yeah. No. I mean, one thing that those phone calls remind me of is that there are real people behind the books, and that sometimes there is the temptation, especially when you're working on a deadline, and a great glib line comes into your head, that it would be very easy to use that line. But those awkward encounters sometimes remind me to put the brakes on that temptation. But in terms of making me a nicer reviewer, I don't think they do.
Have any of you ever been blurbed, you know, where you write a review and some of it is extracted for the ad to sell the book or the movie or the record? Dave, what are your blurbing adventures?
Yeah, I've got a very a perfect example of this, what I consider perfect. You guys can be the critics and decide. It was January 1st, I forget which year, but it was the year that CBS was presenting the Karen Carpenter story. This was, like, I think the day after their triumph with A Very Brady Christmas. So, I mean, two movies, two different years that were the worst of those particular years. But when I wrote my review, I came up with what I thought at the time was a fairly clever lead, starting out by saying that the Karen Carpenter story was the best telemovie of the year. And then I said, however, this is only because this is January 1st, and it is the first telemovie of the year, and no matter what movie comes next on what network, this will usurp it as the best movie of the year. And it would not surprise me if 364 days from now, the Karen Carpenter story wound up, as indeed it did, as the worst movie of the year. Well, I turn on TV that night, and there I am, best telemovie of the year. And I called them up the next morning, and they were roaring with laughter at CBS. They said, "You said it. Did you see the ellipsis? We left." So I learned that lesson.
Do you feel all pretty resistant to the hype machines in the fields that you cover? And has the hype machine changed at all since you started reviewing?
Well, certainly in music, it's now unfashionable to have hype.
It's like unfashionable?
In the sense that there are certain bands now, I mean, Pearl Jam refuses to put out music videos to promote its new album. They refused to, this last time around, to do interviews because they think this would damage their credibility. They would look like they're selling out if they were to actually promote the album that they worked so hard to do. So there's a kind of anti-hype machine that you sort of also get sort of filtered through. I mean, I think, you know, a critic just naturally resists that kind of thing. And I think that they, certainly record companies, I think publishers and to a certain extent TV networks, know that they can't hype critics anymore, really. I mean, it's become such a cliche to sort of say, this is really a great thing and you've got to listen to this. I mean, I think it's more kind of word of mouth, what you hear from colleagues, when you see people in clubs who seem extremely promising, that you really want to hear their first release and that kind of thing. I think the hype is fairly easily resisted these days.
You've all written for different publications, plus worked on radio. And I'm wondering how you're edited differently at different places. Like, David, you've been at I think the Sun Sentinel in
Let's see, Gainesville Sun, Fort Lauderdale News, and Sun Sentinel, Akron Beacon Journal, Philadelphia Inquirer, New York Post, New York Daily News, Baltimore Sun, Fort Worth Star Telegram.
Can't hold a job.
So, and Ken, you've been in Entertainment Weekly, Philadelphia Inquirer, Herald Examiner. Maureen, you've worked at you've written for The Village Voice, The Washington Post. I'm interested in hearing how different publications edit you differently in terms of what they want you to review and the language they want you to use, the kind of stylistic concerns. David, do you have any stories about...
I may be unusual in this, and I have one column that runs right now, and it's syndication in the very narrowest sense of the word. I mean, I have one column, which is my primary job, that runs only in New York, but I have another column that runs not only in New York, but in Philadelphia at the Inquirer, in Fort Worth at the Star-Telegram, and in Baltimore at the Sun simultaneously. So I can look at the, and I send the same thing to all four papers to see what they will do. And if this is a direct answer to your question, the Philadelphia Inquirer editors have 60% less of a sense of humor than the other newspapers.
They edit out your jokes?
3 out of every 5, just gone. And I'm shameless about this. I will write entire items simply to build to the joke. Like I did this one real long thing about the Hunchback of Notre Dame, and pointed out that there were 7 other versions of this made, and this out of all of them, this is the one where the director changed the ending of the original novel the most and changed the direction. And I did probably an hour and a half of background homework just to lead to the joke. That the director's approach on this was obviously, Hugo, your way, and I'll go mine. And in Philadelphia, that line got cut, and there was this dry treatise stuff about, and they're punishing me when they do that, and they know it. So that's...
Maureen, has it been very different getting edited at the Washington Post than at the Village Voice?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But mostly in terms of language. It's odd sometimes to see the more colloquial language that I've used kind of be bumped up, upgraded for the Post. I mean, the oddest continuing experience I have of that, I also write for the New York Observer, and they have this habit of, If I'm referring to an author, say Carol Shields, whose Stone Diaries I just reviewed for Fresh Air, if I were to write that for The Observer, instead of just identifying the author by the last name, they'll identify her as Miss Shields. And it's like little stuff like that that, for me, it doesn't sound like my voice anymore. It's too formal and, I don't know, it gets in the way.
Ken, when you're writing about pop music or television, I mean, I think those are the areas, more than any other area, where everybody has taste. I mean, their own taste, and everybody knows what they like, and they feel like, you know, I know what I like. I know about pop music, I know TV. So do you have editors who are, you know, who know pop music a little bit and know TV, and they think you're wrong?
Yeah.
Because they like that record that you didn't like, or
right.
They like that program that you didn't like, so shape
yes.
up, Ken.
Yeah, this is the curse of the baby boom generation coming to power in positions of authority. In fact, just a few weeks ago, I did this, the new Bonnie Raitt album for the New York Times, and the editor there was a big Bonnie Raitt fan and said, you know, I really think we should quote some lyrics, because I think they're especially cogent on this album. I said, well, you know, I don't think the lyrics are that good. Well, but I think we should just squeeze in one or two, and there was this kind of sort of pressure that I hadn't had, you know, 3 weeks before when I did the Elvis Costello, and he just kind of shrugged and said, oh, nice review. And it went in as I wrote it. So you get that all the time. I mean, I will also bear out David's observation that the Philadelphia Inquirer is the most conservative and hidebound of the places that I've worked for. The first year that I was rock critic there, I spent the entire first year fighting with one of the managing editors who was in charge of the style of the newspaper to use the word kids. Because they only used children or adolescent. And so it was hard to write rock reviews where you're saying, the adolescents were on their seats for AC/DC, and they really seemed to enjoy those young fellows immensely. And I finally got it so I could say the kids were really revved up for this concert. But that's the kind of little things all the time that you encounter.
We're featuring a panel with 3 Fresh Air critics recorded at the recent annual public radio conference. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with the Fresh Air critics panel featuring rock critic Ken Tucker, book critic Maureen Corrigan, and TV critic David Bianculli.
Since you've each written for newspapers as well as magazines, and in a lot of those, in a lot of publications you've written for, there's news as well as arts, entertainment, culture. Do you think there's ever a double standard between the way the news is edited and the way arts and entertainment is edited? For example, what I'm thinking of is that in news, I think the understanding is whether it's a popular story or not,
If it's an important story, it's given the space that it deserves. But if it's arts and entertainment, if it's slightly more esoteric, they might not want you perhaps to write about it. Do you think that there's a different standard applied to arts and entertainment sometimes in publications than there is to hard news?
I think it's more a matter of tone. It's when you have hard news editors editing arts coverage, they're very much focused on the idea that writing should be objective, and my entire career is based on the idea that it should be subjective. And so there's that kind of basic, fundamental, philosophical disagreement that unless you have an arts editor who's really interested in the arts and who can separate him or herself from the kind of hard news objective training that he or she has had, you're really at loggerheads all the time about that kind of thing. And I think that certainly at the Philadelphia Inquirer, that was a big bone of contention that the paper is a superlative hard news organization. I think that its arts coverage is weak precisely because the arts coverage is edited from that kind of hard news perspective. When I was at the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, which is now long folded, a Hearst newspaper that was in desperate competition with the Los Angeles Times, which was not just the dominant paper in town, but the huge monster, overwhelming paper in town, we could write whatever we wanted, because if you made any kind of noise that was heard above Los Angeles Times din, you were doing your job. You were making an impact. And so we got away with murder. We got away with things that, you know, you would only get away with at the Village Voice. I wrote three pieces about a rock star that I made up, I reviewed his albums. I just like tried to start a career for this guy. I had a mask on. I had pictures taken of me as the rock star. Nobody knew this thing. I just did this like three columns. And then,
did you reveal the stunt eventually?
No. No, I got people who wrote in and asked where they could get this guy's records.
What was his name?
Glint Williams. I told them what the deal was, but I just figured I'd see who was reading and who wasn't.
Do you think that the music book and record and film industries see critics and feature writers and us as broadcasters as a part of their public relations arm?
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. What are the manifestations of that?
I just think you try to be as independent as you can, but I think that everyone sort of leeches off everyone else. I mean, you're all sort of waiting around for a work to be produced, and then we all pounce on it and give our own individual pronouncements about whether it's worthwhile or not. And if it's a bad pronouncement, they ignore it. If it's a big pronouncement, they jump on it. It goes on, and you can go three or four. Hopefully, our motives for doing it are for an enthusiasm for the work, and their enthusiasm for doing it as artists is to make the work, and the publicist is to get more people to have enthusiasm and using us. But critics, by definition, would not exist were not there a work there in the first place.
Well, and in recent years in the features area, there's been so much more incursion of kind of press agent being able to control how a story is written that they can get writer approval in some cases, they can get photo approval, and so those so that the publication will meet the terms to get the interview that they need. Seems to me that in magazines and newspapers, this is an area where you can assert your independence because the critic doesn't need to interview, doesn't need to cozy up to the star or the creator of the work, and that's where you prove your independence. Yet, I find that there is that kind of, I mean, even at Entertainment Weekly right now, it's not telling tales out of school to say that there are frequently occasions when they'll want to do a feature on someone and they'll say, we better make the arrangements for that really fast because Ken's got a review coming out that dumps on this show, so we'll never get that star to talk to us if he hasn't agreed to it before he sees this review. There's that kind of nervousness, which I find, very disturbing.
Is this new or has it always been that way?
I've noticed it increasing over the past few years. I think just especially in terms of, it just doesn't have so much to do with critics so much as the lowering of standards, I think, in the features area, that there are too many editors out across the country who have given in to this kind of high-pressure tactics that press agents and movie studios and TV studios have managed to impose on them.
Why do editors give in to that?
it's competition, exclusivity. It's, you know, if you do this, we'll do this for you. If you agree to have this writer who I know is not going to dump on my client, we'll give you this exclusive interview. And it's just that kind of competition is just increasingly so fierce with so many different kinds of magazines and newspapers going after the same small number of big stars that, you know, it the balance of power is shifting back and forth all the time.
I want to ask you a question that often comes up, I think, in public radio and certainly with Fresh Air, and that is dealing with subject matter with sexual content or gay and lesbian guests or something. Do you ever have to deal with subjects where you're writing about an artist who's really out there in their exploration of, like, gender issues or sex or sexual orientation or, you know, avant-garde music even or whatever, something that's considered outside of the mainstream where you have decisions you have to make about whether it's appropriate for your publication or if your editor, you know, does your editor think it's appropriate or what language you will use to describe this out, you know, this adventurous subject matter or whatever. Is that ever an issue for you?
I think most often it happens in terms of the, it becomes very frustrating in the language that you can use and how, like, you want to assume a certain level of knowledge on your reader's parts, mm-hmm. and yet the editors are saying, they'll never get this wacky person you're talking about. You have to start from square A and explain everything. And so you end up writing a far more literal-minded, right. square sort of piece than you ever intended doing about someone you admire and who you want to kind of communicate both to the person you're writing about and to the audience that knows about that person that you understand, that you get it. And yet you're kind of forced to write this, as I say, this kind of very literal-minded sort of prose. And eventually, I think many writers just say, it's not worth the trouble. It's not mm-hmm. worth doing that. So you kind of stop yourself from doing it. In my case, there have been times when I would think, that's not a Philadelphia Inquirer piece, but I could do that for The Voice.
Right.
And so, you know, you would literally do things for The Voice to let off steam, to write the way you want to do, because you have to write in the more formal way at a Philadelphia Inquirer, which, you know, has its own advantages in terms of reaching a much broader audience and a much more kind of mass audience that any kind of critic dealing in pop culture wants to reach. So there are kind of trade-offs back and forth.
The Fresh Air Critics Panel was recorded at the 1994 Public Radio Conference. We heard from rock critic Ken Tucker, TV critic David Bianculli, and book critic Maureen Corrigan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.